Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm one of the co-hosts of this podcast. Today we're joined by Deirdre Ní Cineála, a writer, musician, broadcaster and curator from the Aran Islands off the west coast of Ireland. Working bilingually in Irish and English, she is drawn to voices, contemporary and historical, especially those that have been marginalized, and to what they have to say or to sing. She read music at St. Hilda's College in Oxford, went on to work at the University of Notre Dame and the Library of Congress, and is currently curating an exhibition for Rin na Gaeilge, Department of Irish, at the National University of Ireland, Galway, on the first professor of Irish there, Tomás Amália, and also preparing an anthology of over 50 traditional songs composed in the Aran Islands from the 19th century to the present day. Her new book, Collecting Music in the Aran Islands, A Century of History and Practice, is published now by University of Wisconsin Press, and that is what we're here to talk about today. Deirdre, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Aidan.
So we might just jump straight in. I'm a historian. I don't read a lot in the area of musicology, but one of the things I found really fascinating about your book is something that's very familiar to historians and yet a problem that is quite different, I sense, if you're researching music, that the problem of that you want things to be recorded for posterity and yet they're often not. How does that differ if you're studying music versus just reading people's letters or diaries or whatever it is that historians do?
Yeah, so for any music history, I mean, music being essentially ephemeral, you know, what happened yesterday, a minute ago, it's gone. And so the dream of trying to capture it is as old as literacy itself. And I went back that far when I was trying to trace the history of collecting music. I was just even interested in just even the idea of how can you capture something that's there in a moment and gone again? And also what's the purpose of trying to capture it? It's that you're trying to share knowledge and pass it on. And music historians or anybody wanting to study music of the past, you're so reliant on what has survived, what has been captured, and then even the problems of that being accurate or authentic, just the challenge of trying to capture music before there was audio technology to do it. So it's just an interesting question. And that brings us right back to the very basics of history in the first place, that we're just reliant on traces. And first of all, I was looking for sources of music in Aran, historical sources of music in Aran. And then as I was looking for it, the question was always at the back of my mind, well, why has this survived? Why has this come down to the present day? And what about everything else that hasn't been captured? And to question the lacunae that you observe as you're going along. They're the two, purposes that prompted the book and drove it forward. I mean, I didn't set out to write this book. It sort of it came out of the research. It was all born of curiosity. And over 20 years later, here we are now. Mm-hmm. And it's transferable in the sense that anybody interested in that problem of history of what are we relying on? what survives, how to represent it, how to interpret it. That's very universal, really, for anybody studying the past in any domain whatsoever. And then for music scholarship, you can go even deeper into that and say, well, what exactly can we capture? You know, what are the nuances? What's difficult, if not impossible, to capture? So the challenge maybe even of transcribing music. So for anybody researching Irish song or Shannon's song in particular, for instance, the challenge of trying to capture that and measure it. And we see the impulses that arose in the field of sciences, for instance, to measure things that fed into music scholarship as well, in particular in the 19th century, down to measuring notes and scents and acoustics and all of this. So it's very rich. It touches on lots of different disciplines right across the humanities and the sciences. And it just so happens that the maybe the domain that all of those questions are focused on in this particular book happens to be an element of Irish history and happens to be Irish traditional music.
So I might maybe continue a little bit on with that question of like how you're operating at the intersection of music, musicology and history. On the one hand, there's this ephemerality of music, and it just, as soon as a note is played, it's gone, unless it's actually recorded. And yet you're involved in kind of studying these different case studies of people who went to the Aran Islands. So there is this desire to record music from this particular place. Why were they so interested in the Aran Islands as opposed to, say, the Blasket Islands or Torrey or just places on the Irish mainland? Like what specifically drew them to these pretty small islands?
Well, there's always a fascination with the edge, life on the edge, you know, all of the explorers, when the world was imagined to be flat. It's that there's the same impulse there. It's like, well, what's out there? And also then people maybe bringing their own ideas and locating them in islands as well. So I talk about this in the book, about it, that being a question of perspective as much as maybe origin. You know, it might be sort of easy to pitch it as, well, this is the islander's view, and then this is the view of the other and everybody else outside. But it's more complex than that, because we see islanders that went away writing about home, and maybe others coming in and living and becoming part of the community. So I like to sort of account for that nuance if possible. But in relation to your question on maybe the other islands, the other Irish islands, and islands all over the world have proven to be a source of fascination all through time. From the Greeks on, and but in an Irish context, I suppose the Blaskets, their fame, or rather their emergence into maybe a more national discourse and beyond, is largely thanks to the literature that emerged from the islands in the 20th century. There being, I think it's about 25 books or so that islanders were inspired to write by visitors coming in, and this sense of a discourse in a way. And then with Torrey, same sort of occurrence there, but famously it was painters that the islanders began to paint. And in Aran, Aran, I suppose, maybe stands out for all of the Irish islands in the sense that it was certainly more accessible than either Torrey or the Blaskets, for instance, as accessible almost as Achill. And that's another island that features in this sort of phenomenon. But for Aran, the history is particularly rich because it's a place that has been inhabited for more than 6,000 years continuously. And that would be unique in itself, except that evidence for much of that inhabiting survives in the landscape. You can be standing in a given spot on the island and look around you and see this evidence all around you, and that's unusual. And that's part of the reason that the I suppose the fame and the canon around Aran in particular has arisen, because it was just so attractive to people to come and witness this and see it and study it. And then also imagine that not only are we seeing the traces all around in the material culture, but that traces might also present in the cultural expression that was in the islands at any given time. And that connection feeds the urge to document that which is in the islands, whether it's folklore or stories or history, or in this case, music.
maybe we could talk about a little more this question of like, there's something authentic there that you're getting access to, and it's sort of authentically Irish. There are basically a number of case studies that you do in your book of different collectors who go to the islands. So if we start maybe first with George Petrie and Eugene O'Curry, my first question I was going to ask about them was, are they just nationalists? Is that really what's motivating them?
I'm not sure it would be entirely fair to I suppose lead with that, because I mean, there is a national discourse throughout all of their work and even the different elements of their work as well, and it's of that period as well. I mean, the society that was founded, the Society for the Preservation of Irish Melodies, for instance, I mean, that is part of a nationalist project in a sense, but maybe it's a sort of political with a small p. It's they're firmly in the, it's an intellectual life, I think, that they're interested primarily, and that's how it is framed. Any of the discussions around this kind of work that relates to the music side of it or the cultural side of it, it is about that question of language and history and memory, and not really connecting directly or overtly, I should say, maybe to the nationalist efforts that were ongoing at the time. Now, at the same time, you know, we do see the figures that are involved in the more overtly political side of those activities, that they're supporting these kinds of works, of course, because it's ideologically, it makes sense. I suppose it's feeding that expression of a particular identity, and that they've, so there's lots of different motives, perhaps. And looking back now, we might try to read those motives, but it's also important to bring as much balance as possible to try and assess, well, mm-hmm. you know, how important is the political side to this? I look at that particular visit to Aran as maybe not entirely, it is exceptional, but not completely unique in a sense. If we look at it, they're towards the end of their long careers at this stage, and they are sort of they're bringing gravitas to this occasion in being present for this visit to Aran. There was a big conference up in Dublin, British Academy for the Advancement of Sciences, or some title like that, I can't remember just now. And then they're there for the week, they have their conference, and then it's the junket at the end of the week, and they go down for the weekend to the island with a vessel organized especially, borrowed from the equivalent of the Irish Lights that would normally be servicing lighthouses that were being that network was growing out around the coast. And so they're bringing in 70 antiquarians into the Aran Islands, and this is the moment when really the archaeological career for Aran in the modern world is launched. Brendan O'Hehir called it Aran's coming out into the modern world. And so they come and they arrive, and there aren't any decent roads, so but ship is the only way they can transport that number of people. So they come in and they'll come ashore at a convenient landing point, and then they'll climb a hill and look at a remains of a chapel or a fort, and then back to the ship, and then round the island and into another landing point. So it's a major operation. And as I say, Petrie and O'Curry are there, and that's they're lending their authority of all of their scholarship, and also of their the philosophy around this, the value of it, granting authority to what is there locally, not just in the stones and the material they're seeing everywhere, the evidence of the past, but then the collecting of music is also granting authority to the community themselves. But there is an argument to say that maybe the music that they captured on that occasion maybe is one of the few ways in which they're acknowledging the islanders of the time, of their own day, because the focus is very much on this glorious Irish past that is a vision for the nationalist rhetoric of the time. So it is an important element, but maybe it's not it's serving a different purpose. It's informing the activities that are happening around that time politically, we'll say, but the focus seems to be very much in a kind of idealistic, really.
So there's obviously a number of different strands all running through this about antiquarianism and a certain kind of cultural nationalism and then just music collecting. It's obviously a big event when they come. Are they remembered today in the Aran Islands, or how in general is this big event remembered?
Well, if you go and visit the Oneingasa today and you pass through the Gate Lodge where the OPW count all the visitors of well over 100,000 that come per annum from all over the world, you will pass an illustration up on the wall that tells this, that story. But if you were to meet any islander, they're not necessarily going to, it isn't going to be a memory that was passed on locally, mm-hmm. because there have been so many people coming before and in particular since then that merges into this whole fabric of a flow of visitors coming all the time with an interest and making the islands themselves a point of interest. But there is an awareness locally of the canon of people capturing knowledge at different times and preserving it in some way, maybe disseminating it through publication, maybe not. And there is an appetite locally now to access that information, and it is regarded maybe as by the community as its own history, and at the same time understood as being, you know, have a lot of the time, most of the time, being written by people that were visiting, so that relationship is there. The sense of the value of history, people living with it, it's through the oral practice of memory and folklore locally that's still vital, but also you know, there's a huge respect for literature and writing and history and all of that, because a lot of islanders would be readers anyway, as in, you know, they've read a lot of their own writers and read what was written about the place as well. And then of course the islands themselves, I mean, you mentioned the Blaskets, but Aran has its own history, very rich history of literature written by islanders themselves in both in Irish and in English. So It's maybe not now, maybe the most significant way in which that visit impacts life is the tourism industry that keeps the islands going now. It is the number one industry in the islands for the last two, three decades or so. And before that, it would have been a bit more mixed. But it's the visit isn't, no one's going to remember that Petrino Curry came to collect music. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a 150th anniversary of that 1857 visit where history repeated itself and the Irish Quaternary Association came out with a whole load of people, and there were soil experts and paleobotanists and people standing having a discussion on whether or not there had been a tsunami up at Dundachar that explained why apparently half the fort appears to be missing. So that appetite for inquiry and locating it in this landscape that lends itself to it, because it's there and it's all around you, and it's very powerful for people. You know, people do really experience that there's a that the place is special in some way. I had a friend who came and visited. She's from Utah originally, and she's been up and down the Colorado River, whitewater rafting. She's been places where she knows nobody has set foot, and she went walking around the island and said, she said, everywhere I can see where humans have been, because every stone wall, a human hand handled that stone. So while you may be walking around in a landscape and not encounter anybody, say, in the middle of February, it's been deeply inhabited. And that informs that practice ever since. So that you get that sense in all of the source material related to the Aran Islands. Everybody has that feeling when they're there. And it's feeding the whole canon, as I say, and the activity. Mm-hmm. It's still alive as ever.
So if we maybe jump ahead about 100 years or so, the second case study you engage with is Seamus Ennis, who's obviously, I think, maybe a lot better known as a musician in his own right, and yet also has this other career as a music collector. So what motivated him to go to the Aran Islands?
So it was his job. He was working at that time for the Irish Folklore Commission, as it was called. The collection is now the National Folklore Collection housed at UCD. But that commission was founded in the 30s, the Irish Folklore Institute before that. So the 20s and 30s. So this is the birth of the modern Irish state. And now it's, the, you know, there's the country has its own government to continue this project of identity in a sense. But it's also tied in with the fate of the language. So the urge was to collect and to publish. And so the focus is quite a bit on texts and transcription and publishing. And that's important because it impacts the decisions that were taken then as the organization was being run on a shoestring. And they had to make very difficult choices, like wiping cylinder recordings and reusing the cylinders again for want of resources. So it's very easy for us maybe to be critical of that, those activities, those actions. We have the benefit of hindsight, of course, but those were the times that they lived in, but also not just the lack of resources, but as I say, the focus on text and getting things published and generating a transcription. In some ways, it was acceptable. It was part of the I don't want to call it a protocol, but the practice that arose from that. So Ennis was hired because he had a combination of skills. He was musically literate. He was a fluent speaker of Irish and, of course, a superlative musician himself. And he had the charisma, the personal skills that he could be an ambassador in a sense for this institution and go and persuade and cajole people to contribute to the project, which amassed an enormous collection of manuscripts from all over the country over decades. I mean, it'd be one of the most valuable such archives in the world, certainly in a European context. So Ennis was hired in 1942. So by 45, I mean, he's gone around the country on a bicycle because it's the war and his rations and all sorts, and it's likely he would have had Aaron on his itinerary because it's the Gaeltacht area, and he had been in Connemara before that and he had heard mention of Aaron, so it was pretty natural that he would come. What's interesting is that he just spent, I think, overall the guts of 2 weeks there before resuming activities elsewhere and carrying on to other locations, visiting Connemara frequently. I mean, he had friends there and he built up relationships there. And I talk in that chapter about, those motivations to maybe spend more time in certain localities than others, maybe to go back to people that I suppose maybe were easy to work with as well. Not to say that he had any difficulty working with people in Aran, but he didn't have an easy time. So his episode in Aran, in the whole context of his oeuvre in general, it's sort of a more everyday example. There's a lot of research done on his relationship with Colm O'Cian, that Rinnoch Eogan, for instance, has been publishing on, and a very rich scene there. But it's also interesting to see, well, what was it like when he was just with maybe everybody else, not the stars, in a sense. And that's what I set out to look at in Aran. And the detail of his diary helped. There are some recordings that he managed to capture in Dublin, where he persuaded one of the singers he'd encountered in the island. It looks to me like he was the one to suggest she go up to Dublin to compete in Eilifta Sna Gaeilge, which she did. She went to visit the there, and I don't know whether she competed, but she did attend. And what they used to do is when singers came or musicians came from all over the country to participate in that event, they would bring them down to Earlsford Terrace, bringing the mountain to Muhammad, so to speak, and they were able to record them on site there, and that just made it easier for him. So, I mean, if he wasn't in the early days using the machine all that frequently, because he was so adept at transcription anyway, at musical transcription in particular. So it's not surprising maybe to see that he wouldn't have brought the apparatus with him on Corrochs and hookers and all sorts of weathers and risking damage to it. I mean, that's one possible reading of it. But it's another valuable collection because it's one of the early ones. I mean, you know, we've leapt forward, as you say, nearly 100 years. Mm-hmm. There are other collections in between, but they weren't in sufficient state of accessibility for me to write comprehensively on them. You know, collections that need cataloging, etc. So that's how come there's a bit of a gap there.
So he's coming in a sense as like as a representative of the Irish government, or at least of like a semi-state organization, which has a very clear mission about collecting and documenting the supposedly authentic culture of Ireland that they feel is about to disappear. And I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that, of the politics of all this, about what gets counted as authentic or inauthentic. You mentioned a few times that some of these collectors come and they hear people singing in English and they never record that because they're singing even like quite contemporary popular music. They want this like real authentic music.
So I mentioned the resources as well. I mean, because the resources were so slim, the focus emerges pretty clearly that they are focusing on Irish language material. And I mean, the fact of Enis spending so much time in the Gaeltachtaí demonstrates that as well before he's written anything down is the choice of where he goes. So, for instance, the urban areas wouldn't necessarily be as well represented in the Folklore Commission collections because they weren't conceptualizing of folklore as being something that belonged to an urban area. At the time, the understanding was that the richest folklore was going to survive in the places where maybe the oldest possible material would survive, and the association of that being within Irish language culture and Irish language practices, and thus being drawn to Gaeltacht communities. I mean, the ghost of the famine really is hanging over this and the impact of it. It did inform Petrie. He spoke about it overtly, talking how the land of song, you know, had fallen silent in a way. And we hear that idea of silence, the acoustic of it. We hear that being mentioned. So in a sense, that's underlying all of this, the fear, because the reality was that it was the language was continuing to recede in some sense. I mean, we can say that it changed, but the perception was that it was receding and that material was being lost all of the time. So the pressure was on, the clock was ticking, and for that reason, the focus, the prioritisation was very clear from the start, and it is part of that government project. The other question was, of course, that sometimes some of these initiatives were drew on the Department of Education as well, because they were they had schemes whereby they were trying to provide material in the Irish language to enable the education system to, I suppose, function. So that's in the background as well. The publishing environment, the other objectives are feeding into this and are sort of informing it. So for Enis, then, I mean, his focus, he works with the Folklore Commission for 5 years, and then moves to Radio Éireann, I suppose marginally better pay for similar work. And then similar move again in 1952 when he moves on to the BBC. And there's a sort of a theme there. He's still essentially, you know, on a day-to-day basis, practically doing the same thing, visiting people and collecting their music. But the purpose changes slightly then when it's for radio as opposed to for the Folklore Commission. But you can see him still visiting the same people. And so we begin to see how you might get these canonical performances or repertoires emerging and forming, you know, what we think of now as maybe the classic recordings or standards.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So we sort of jumped about 100 years, and if I could jump kind of in space now as well as in time, you then switch to a person called Sidney Robertson Cowell, who's a really fascinating person, who seems to have very different motivations for going to the Aran Islands. Initially, it seems like she's coming from the US and she feels that she's kind of identifying the original origins of American folk music. And then she kind of grows and develops as she goes to the Aran Islands and collects music there. Could you tell us some more about her and about her trajectory through the Aran Islands?
Sure. So Sydney was born in California in 1903. And by the time she's an Aran, she comes in 1955 for the first time. At that stage, she spent 20 years on and off collecting folk music. That first began with John Lomax, father of Alan Lomax, through the archive of folk song that was forming at the Library of Congress at that time. This is during the Great Depression. So there are, through the Works Progress Administration, I think it's the WPA, there were schemes where culture was being, afforded an opportunity to impact people's lives and try and improve their lives because there was such destitution across the states and population movements, etc. So, but quickly, Sydney, she's a very different character to John Lomax, for instance, and Frank C. Brown. They're the two that she heads off with initially. And just socially, and how they're, she didn't like how they were responding to Black people that they met and recorded. And it's not that they were sort of intended to be in any way discriminatory in their behavior, but just they ended up being so. So she wasn't very happy with that. In any case, she was so independent minded herself. It wasn't long before she went out on her own and was recording in the Midwest first and all over the place out to California. So at that time, you had maybe more and more people conducting field recording throughout America, because the equipment was becoming more common, I guess. And you've different collectors, whether they're men or women, and a lot of the women collectors aren't so well known, not surprisingly, but there's lots of them. And for Sydney, she, I guess, observed that there were patterns, that the focus initially, not unlike the Irish context, was on, for instance, Native American nations and their cultures, and also Hispanic as well, again, representing, I suppose, the recent history of the Americas from the perspective of the US. But then she's out in California and she gets funding from the government to do a big project to get a greater diversity of ethnicities involved in this collecting work. So all the European migrations that had occurred, she's capturing those communities. And even from, she plans then to expand it to include Asians, Assyrians, all sorts that were there all around her in California. But then with World War II, the funding was getting redirected and hits a thunas, as we say, that project ended. She was looking around, looking for more work all the time. So interested in that activity of collecting, and she was good at it. She was good with people, and she had studied languages in college. She studied music as well. And so she continued with that throughout that 20-year period insofar as she could. She married Henry Cowell, the avant-garde composer, in the early 40s. And after that, then she's not doing quite so much collecting. So the episode in Ireland is interesting for that reason, because, you know, she becomes a supporter of Henry's career and the opportunities that she allows for herself are fewer. Henry was friends with the filmmaker Robert Flaherty. So in 1934, when they were premiering Man of Aran on Broadway, and there were Aran Islanders over for that, the stars of the film, Henry had sort of chaperoned them when they were in Manhattan, and he had recorded them at the New School for Social Research in New York. And that incident must have come to mind then 21 years later, when they're going to Europe. Henry's got a tour of concerts and they want a holiday in Ireland. And Henry says the one person he wants to see is Maggie Duran, the woman he'd recorded 21 years earlier in New York. And they stayed in my grandparents' guest house. They went to visit Maggie and they discovered that Maggie hadn't been recorded since, and her son John hadn't been recorded at all. And within a week, Sydney came back to the island. She had contacts in the BBC. She managed to get a machine, and she sort of abandoned Henry and said, off you go, I'm going back to Ireland. And she spent 2 weeks on the island then recording people in the east and west end of the island. A year later, she was able to come back again, because by then they had got a big funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, and they were going to go on this world tour, which eventually got cut short, but it meant that she was able to come back and spend 6 weeks in Ireland. However, she had a different machine this time and it let her down. And in the end, she was only able to record for the guts of a week, which was very frustrating, I'm sure, considering all the context she had built up in that time. But she, you know, at this stage, she's done it for 20 years and she just seemed to sort of get on with it and accept her fate. I mean, for instance, the machine broke down when she was in Inishmeon, and at the time the ferry only ran twice a week, and then the weather is bad and she was sick and she thought the machine was fixed and went back to the island and it broke again. So it's just this litany of challenges. But the recordings are valuable because they're they weren't the very first made in Inishmeon. Radu Éireann had been there with the BBC in 1949. But a lot of those recordings don't survive. That's due to the institutional histories in Radu Éireann. And we're just really lucky that Sydney's did. And I was able to first work with those over 20 years ago, visiting the Library of Congress, and then 10 years ago, being able to go there as a fellow and actually live there and work there and spend so much more time, not just with those materials, but also with Alan Lomax's. And she just emerges as this extraordinary figure. I had a lot of help in piecing together her career because, you know, there's no one book written about Sydney. And Cheryl Kaskowitz has been researching her, and Kathy Kirst as well has a publication coming out all about that, her work in California. So, but in terms of her overseas work, I think maybe I was the first person to look at what she was doing overseas. She recorded in Iran, I think Pakistan as well, and might have gone further, as I say, but for that trip got cut short.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned how your grandparents kind of pop up a little bit in this story of Sidney Robertson Cowell. And you went, the last case study you engage in is Barbara Quinn, who's another relative of yours. What's it like to study, rather than someone that you feel a kind of great sense of distance from, but actually study the musical collecting of a relative?
Well, you approach them in the same way. You know, you're always mindful of people's dignity, and I don't see any difference in a sense in how you'd approach them. Now, I suppose it is different when you're living, like with, you know, living subjects in a sense. If you're living in the community, yes, I mean, you're living with your work in a sense. And you will, I really appreciate the trust that the community places in my effort. And I particularly appreciate as well when I, you know, they'll see to correct me as well. That's a difficult thing for somebody to come and do and say, by the way, you know, you, because it might be taken as a critique, but I need that. I need people to trust me to receive that with grace and say, okay, yes, we can do this better, you know, so it's a collaboration. I see myself as sort of the facilitator to try and enrich the history and maybe bring some of the island's own authority in a sense and its own knowledge to improve what's in the historical record. So I remember, you know, right up until the last minute, you know, whether it's footnotes or anything, going to great lengths to ensure that things were accurate, because that's important. That's really, mm-hmm. really important for a community that is being represented so much from outside. A lot of mythologizing, a lot of sort of tourist blurbs, etc., that can really wear, you know, that's the impact of tourism on any community, but in particular intensive tourism, is really important. It's not, I mean, we hear now people talking about ecotourism, but I mean there's ethical tourism to think of as well, and any effort to represent the history of the islands needs to bear that in mind, I think. So I don't view it as sort of as an uncomfortable position to occupy at all. It's a remarkable privilege. But, you know, with that kind of position, there is responsibility as well. So it's the same negotiation for anybody, you know, as I was mentioning in the book, for anybody that was trying to contribute in some ways to the historical record. It doesn't matter where you're coming from, in a sense. I think the responsibilities are the same.
So after going through all these case studies, you then provide like quite serious appendices that in a way kind of are getting at similar issues of the need for accuracy. and particularly like trying to line up the different notes that Petrie and O'Curry produced when they're in the Isles. Can you tell us a little bit about that? About maybe it's the more like the technical work of being a musicologist.
Yeah, it is. I mean, at this point, this is where the music training kicks in, you know, that you're going through the music notation and reading exactly what's going to read into it. What's an error and what's genuine. So I was extremely fortunate in the course of this research that manuscript material that I was seeking actually emerged while I was looking for it, in a sense. Now, it was about 6 or 7 years into the project, but it's still better late than never. Dáilvigh Ócróin, recently retired professor of medieval history in Galway, he was out in Leipzig and he came upon the Stokes papers there, and amongst those were 10 songs that had been transcribed in Aran. I was lucky that he knew me, that he knew my work, and also that he recognised what he was looking at, you know, when he saw the date of 1857 and Aran Mór and that written. Because, I mean, it's, you know, a handful of pages amongst stacks of pages, and who knows what the other materials were. You know, it's not that there was that there was an obvious path to it, or that they had been catalogued to reveal their presence. So that enabled me then to see if we could, I suppose, restore them, marry those words with the melodies that had been transcribed by Petrie. So O'Curry, being the Irish speaker, was able to transcribe the lyrics. They're over in Leipzig. There's actually two duplicates in the Royal Irish Academy as well, of two of the songs. And then the melodies are mostly in the National Library and some in Trinity as well. So they've been studied. Marion Deasy had produced a PhD on it, and there's been books thereafter as well. But then to have lyrics from that time, like that are actually matching these melodies, is really rare. Because it can be difficult if the manuscripts haven't been well enough identified. It can be really difficult. The episode in Aran was, as I say, was exceptional in that it was an instance of fieldwork. We don't have that much evidence to show that Petrie and O'Curry were sort of going off into the field together. They were in Dublin. They were in Petrie's parlour, collecting from people there and transcribing material. But the Aran episode is particularly well identified. So that enabled it. Dáilvigh finding the material and the fact that it was pretty well identified sort of gave me confidence in trying to do this. So the first appendix tries to identify the melodies and say if there's a title in English and say, well, this is probably whichever song in Irish. So Donal O'Daly is more than likely Donal O'Daly. And so that we can take from that, well, it looks like that song was part of the repertoire at the time. And then where the lyrics came up then, I had fun trying to match them up with the different tunes and sort of singing the song words to different tunes to see, is this the likely match? Maybe it's this not quite identified clearly. So it's an attempt. And it was done once before by Brendan Nomadagon with, I think he only had one or two texts where he was able to do something similar. So this is maybe the first time that we've been able to do it with a batch from the same period as well, and with the same singers. So all of that analysis and trying to work with the music sources and draw as much from, glean as much information from them, that's all in the first appendix. And then the other major appendix is a digital catalogue. So it's not in the book. It's cited mm-hmm. in the book, and then you can go look it up on the Traditional Music Archives website, because I'm grateful to them being able to partner with them on this. And people can go on there and search for Sidney Robertson Cowell, and they'll find there's a whole blog post, and there's the different file formats for the digital catalogue available there for people to use. And it's at item level. So every single one of the performances, there's over 200 of them. And there's metadata for all of those, where it was recorded, date, place where the person was from, titles, all of that stuff. And also, this is maybe the most valuable part, the additional, the bonus that you wouldn't expect maybe in that kind of metadata roll call, is all of the archives, because her materials are scattered across 4 or 5 different repositories. And I wanted to account for the duplicates, because sometimes you'll have primary duplicates. You could have secondary duplicates as well. So Sydney would have talked about wanting the Folklore Commission to have copies of her recordings, also Radio Éireann. In a sense, she was doing that to, I don't want to say grease the wheels, but she wanted to cultivate a culture of openness and encourage dialogue across these different institutions. And that was one of the motives for making that offer. But because of that, for instance, the Folklore Commission have one or two of her tracks. The BBC have a series of tracks that were selected by Seamus Ennis to retain there. And then the whole lot of them are over in America. But if you come along now today, say somebody wants to use one of those tracks, it's so much easier now at an item level to say, okay, I want to use this. Who do I approach if for rights or clearing or anything like that? And I mean, there's archives all over the place that really, they resist when people come asking for, oh, can I use this, that, and the other? And they'll just say, look, you have to go and figure this out. And it can be really, really difficult for people to find out, well, where do I go? And so for this, that resolves all of that. All the information is there, one-stop shop. And that's a potential model for collections in the future. And it could be for any type of collection, whether it's a manuscript or a printer. But for audio, that's particularly useful because the duplicates can occur. Like there is loads of duplicates in Alan Lomax's collection, for instance, that he didn't make. And what I see happening now is people attributing recordings to him, but it's a duplicate. He didn't actually make it. Maybe he never met the person that's on the tape. Mm-hmm. So in terms of accuracy, you know, that's sort of at a systems level and saying, well, how do we make life easier for everyone here?
So, I mean, that does sound incredibly satisfying to be able to put all that together.
Well, I don't know if producing it I would call satisfying. It's more just a great huge spreadsheet and lots of marks saying to be resolved or find what's the answer to, you know, solve all these mm-hmm. puzzles. So it's the biggest jigsaw puzzle you could possibly think of. And as I say, across different institutions. And I mean, this is partnership that I couldn't have achieved that without the contributions of the various archives and archivists and librarians, etc. I mean, where would we be without them? It's just it's a vital part of the process, and that was important as well, given this work is happening in a very international setting. I mean, I wasn't always able to access the places or go and visit them. That's an experience we're all very familiar with in the last 2 years. And there's a community, there's a network there of people who are very generous with their time and their knowledge to help ensure there's accuracy for everybody.
So maybe if I could ask one final question. You talked earlier about like almost the burden of having to resist this kind of mythologizing and even like the cliches that exist with the Aran Islands. And we could imagine a book like this having a very cliched cover image of, you know, Dunangus or stone fields or people in Aran sweaters. Yet you have this very surreal image on the cover. Can you tell us some more about that?
Sure. I'm really thrilled. And I should give credit to the University of Wisconsin as well for publishing this book, and also for the way that we managed to pull it all off across a 6-hour time difference and not meeting people at all, correspondence. So the choice of the cover here was really this emerged kind of through instinct. There's an artist from the island called Sean O'Flaherty, whose work I really like. And when I was looking for cover images, I stumbled on a project in which he was involved. He was the first artist to contribute to a sequential work. It's a bit like Pass the Parcel. So he produced an image, passed it on digitally to another artist who then added to it. So there's layers and layers and layers. So there's three different artists from Inishmore who have contributed to it, and then a whole bunch of other artists as well. The project was curated by Alana Robbins for the residency scheme, the arts center out in Connemara called Interface Aina, and the work's called Carrying the Songs, and that's inspired by Moya Cannon's poem. And there's a line in that poem where she's talking about how songs move with people as they migrate, and she says songs were their soul's currency, the pure metal of their hearts. And I loved how a book about collecting music gets to sort of foreground in that image and be reminded that it's framed around the people that were maybe holding the pen or holding the microphone, but it's a partnership with the singers and the musicians who contributed to it as well, and who actually carry the songs forward. And in the end, I mean, Sydney talks about this, that the desire is to that they're sharing the same goal, that at the end of the day, they want the music to pass on to the next generation. And my aunt, Barbara Quinn, who's the subject of the final chapter, and I'm sort of coming to realize as I'm going to be, you know, with a book launch in the offing, I've been thinking about, you know, what have I learned from all of this, you know, and I'm still learning in some sense. And more I realize how her legacy in being a collector, working from within, in a sense, in the island, I think the legacy of that has another life. I mean, the collection itself is its own legacy. But in the way that it has informed this book and the arguments in the book around how and why we're collecting music, how we conceive of it, that the first three collectors, really, for them it's firmly about work. It's the work of collecting. But for Barbara, a lot of it is about play and playfulness. And it gives it a completely different feeling and sense. And so I'm pleased that the cover sort of evokes that sense, which is captured in Moya's poem, and also in that artwork called Carrying the Songs. And people can look it up online to see how the image has changed over time, that it's alive in a sense. I'm really pleased with it.
Mm-hmm. There's obviously a number of layers there, and it seems quite apt then that you have that for a book that is itself very layered and is bringing together all these different disciplines and referencing a very collaborative endeavor. As you said, it's out now with the University of Wisconsin. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, echoing what you're saying, that it was organic. It was very organic. I didn't set out to write this book. It emerged. And then that work as well, the artwork emerged. And then that the two should combine, it ended up being really, really fitting for it. So, and I mean, it's the first. There's the next book is the songbook for all the, as you mentioned at the start. And so in some ways, this is really a foundation for everything that will follow. But I'm looking forward to seeing how maybe the stories and arguments made in the book inspire other people in how they look at these, at other archives and other musics.
Well, I can definitely attest to the fact that it's a very excellent piece of work, and it's out now with Wisconsin Press and very much worth checking out. Thanks so much, Deirdre, for joining us.
Thanks a million, Aidan.